Ladies and gentlemen, firstly, I would like to say thank you to Oxford Union for inviting me to speak to this very important audience. Firstly, I would like to say something about my own country, Malaysia. Malaysia, at independence, chose a democratic system of government. And for 60 over years, the system worked quite well. But we also found a lot of weaknesses in the system. It is possible, for example, for leaders who are elected to abuse their position, especially the Prime Minister, and reduce that democracy of ours into a kind of dictatorship. Now, this happened quite some time ago, but it is something that was not expected, which happened with the 14th general election. On the 9th of May, the single party, which had ruled the country for 60 over years, lost to the opposition. This has never happened before. And the people were so keen to see a change in the government that despite all efforts by the government of that time to stop people from voting for the opposition parties, the opposition won with a clear majority. This is unprecedented. It had never happened in Malaysia because from the time of our independence, we had only one government. Different leaders, of course. There were altogether six leaders by the time we had our 14th general election. But at the 14th general election, for the first time, the people showed that they wanted a change of government. Some people may say that this one party running the country for 60 years cannot be democratic. I would like to say that it is not so democratic as compared to countries like those in Europe, like here, the United Kingdom, America, and the rest. But what happens is that despite certain deficiencies, the party won the elections repeatedly, and there were no serious accusations that the government or the government party had fiddled with the election system. But this time it is different. The people really wanted to change the government. They were afraid, because Malaysians are very timid people. They don't take to the streets easily. Surely they don't show any tendency towards violence. So they suffered in silence. But they felt the oppression quite as strongly as other people would when they demonstrate in the streets or go on strike. But during the election, there was still no expectation that the government party would be losing the election. But on the 9th of May, or rather 10th of May of last year, it soon became clear that the government party, despite manipulations, had lost to the opposition coalition or opposition parties. It took a bit of time for the government to admit that it has lost. Indeed, it influenced the Election Commission not to announce the winners from the opposition, but to announce only the winners from the government party. So initially, we could see that the government party was again winning. But towards the end when they ran short of winners, they had to announce that there were opposition winners also, and that their numbers exceed that of the government party. But the announcement did not take place until about 2 in the morning, because by then the attempts to set up a different coalition government had failed. And Malaysia had the first change of government in its history since independence. Now, as you can see, even elected leaders or prime ministers can abuse his power to the extent that people became very scared of him, were afraid of him. Even when he abuses the laws of the country, still there were no outright demonstration of disapproval by the people. That was that government at that time. And now, of course, the opposition coalition has taken power and is trying to bring back all the democratic features of an independent democratic country. We are reducing the power of the Prime Minister by transferring it more to the Parliament than to the Prime Minister, so that he will not, people will not feel obliged to support him. Beyond that, of course, we are reinstalling the rule of law, which is very important. It was ignored during the previous government. But in the end, the election system proved that Malaysia is democratic. Many people would dispute what I say, because many people think that Malaysia is not very democratic. But I would like to tell you that since independence, it has held 14 elections, and there was not much complaints about the elections except the last one. So in terms of the people selecting their leaders, Malaysia has proven that it is democratic to that extent. Maybe there are certain things which do not seem to be democratic enough. For example, we inherited a law from our colonial masters called the ISA. It is about security of the country, and it gives power to the government and the Prime Minister, of course, the right to arrest people without trial. That is, of course, something that nobody likes these days, because it is very undemocratic. But even in a democracy, a leader like the previous government leader was able to abuse the laws of the country and rule the country more or less as a dictatorship. Now, when I say this, I'm reminded, of course, that I myself was a prime minister who was accused of being a dictator. Of course, many people believed I was a dictator. How else could he govern the country except by being a dictator? I just would like to point out that in the history of nations, there has not been a single dictator who stepped down while he was in power and allowed others to take over from him. Dictators don't usually resign or retire. They like to be dictators until the day of their death. So, to that extent, we claim that Malaysia is a democracy. But democracy can be manipulated in many ways, and democracy is very difficult to work. It's so complex. So many people have freedom, and they can do what they like, say what they like. And this is not something that strong people tolerate. But democracy is good in the sense that it allows people to choose their own government. To that extent, democracy has proven to be the right form of government. But we see attempts now to force democracy on all the countries in the world. Democrats have now become very intolerant of other systems. They want to abolish other systems of government to the point where if you don't change, you don't become a democracy, you are not democratic, your country will be invaded in order to put in a new leader. That, I think, is completely against the concept or the idea of democracy. Democracy should not be forced upon people. People should make their own choices, and the other powers should not threaten to do something to ensure that the leader is democratic. The act of forcing countries to become democratic is itself undemocratic. But this is what has happened now, because Democrats have become very intolerant to the extent that they are prepared to go to war, to kill people, to destroy whole countries if these countries do not embrace democracy. So that is why I believe that democracy can only exist and help the country to prosper if people understand what democracy is all about. We think that people understand that the majority should rule, but to achieve majority, you have to have elections, and the losers do not feel happy about losing. They would like themselves to win, and so when they lose, they disrupt the whole country. They go to the streets and have demonstrations. In some cases, it ends up with civil war even, because the losers, even if they are democratic, do not want to accept losing an election. They feel that it was not right just because people put a tick in a square area, therefore they would not become the government. And so what we see today is what is known as the Arab Spring. I don't think the Arabs regarded it as their spring, while outsiders call it the Arab Spring. At that time, everybody feels that when the Arabs become democratic, then of course they will be doing just as well as the old democracies. But the facts have shown that when they embrace democracy and try to practice it, they got into a lot of trouble. We see what's happening in Syria, for example. The attempt to overthrow the dictatorial government has resulted in war, war between the people within the Syria itself, and we see people running away by the millions from their own country because they feel that they would be better off outside of Syria. On the other hand, we find that during the time of the authoritarian government, not so many people will be killed because of disputes or anything else. It is true, perhaps, that some people would be thrown into jail without trial, would even be tortured, but the number of deaths is far less than what we see in the attempt to impose democracy on the country. We see a lot of wars being fought, people being killed and injured, and the whole country devastated. So while we think that democracy is the best form of government, we have to remember that these people are not familiar with the system. They have had autocratic government for centuries, but to turn them into democracies overnight is something that is very disruptive and can result in wars. Democrats must always remember that it took a long time for democracy to be accepted and practiced by any country. It took almost 200 years for democracy to be practiced in this country. They had time to enunciate what democracy is all about and to practice it in stages. Of course, in England, for example, in the early phase, only landlords were allowed to vote. Others were not allowed to vote. It took a long time before women were allowed to vote. And then it took a much longer time for other categories of people to gain the right to vote for their government. So the time taken permits the people to adjust themselves to this new idea that a tick in a square is sufficient for a government to be overthrown. It takes a long time, and this time is not given to the new democracies in the Arab countries. Overnight, they had to change from a dictatorial kind of government to this new form of democracy. We see, for example, the overthrow of dictators. The people were united in wanting to overthrow the dictators. But once the dictator is overthrown, then the people who overthrew the dictator now begins to quarrel among themselves as to who has the right to rule. You may have elections, but of course the losers invariably dispute the results of the election. So now what we see is turmoil instead of democracy in this country. I believe that democracy is a very good system, but people must be given time to adjust to the democratic system. They have to learn to be patient. They have also to learn that in a democracy, not all parties can win. Somebody must lose if somebody is going to win. And the losers must accept that they have lost, and therefore they have to wait until the next election before trying again. But what we see is that when they lose the election, invariably they would accuse the winners of cheating or fraud, etc., and we refuse to accept the winning party as the government. So because of that, you see a lot of turmoil in these new democracies because they are not used to the system and they cannot understand why somebody's little mark on a piece of paper could result in their being defeated. So that is the situation that we see today in many new countries trying to adopt the system, the democratic system. But Malaysia has been very fortunate in that the transition from being a colony to an independent country is smooth. Malaysians did not fight for independence. We negotiated our independence. And because we did not fight and we negotiated, then the people who are most capable of governing took over power in Malaysia. And with that, the country was able to be ruled after the colonial powers were ousted. The people could take over the government and were able to help rule the country and develop the country. This is what we have in Malaysia today. And we hope that this idea that a short stroke on a piece of paper will determine who governs the country must be understood and accepted by the people in Malaysia. Currently, some people are still unable to accept the concept. They are strongly attached to their leaders to the point where they will not do anything, even when the leader does a lot of wrong things. they continue to support, not because the government was good, but because they are attached to the leader of their choice. So when you have this strong type of obedience towards a leader, then democracy can actually be sidelined and pushed aside so that a dictatorship would result. This is what happened in Malaysia. So we have had an experience, I have had the experience of winning, of losing, of winning without any contest, and also of winning many elections. But instead of leading the party that I was, that made me the Prime Minister for 22 years, I am now the leader of the opposition to the very party that I led. Yeah, this is, of course, quite funny, because they used to call me a dictator and other nasty names. And yet, when I left my old party, they accepted me and named me as the next Prime Minister, and not one of their own men to take over from the government party if we should win. But I don't know what it means to them, but they somehow or other, the opposition party somehow or other realized that maybe what they said about me was not quite right. I think so. But we nevertheless have learned to work together. We are still in the process of teaching people about democracy. Democracy is about choosing leaders to govern the country. It's not about putting your relative or friend up as candidate, because then you can access him very easily. In Malaysia, I was accused of cronyism, because a lot of people did very well during the time, 22 years I was a Prime Minister. It seems that because people did well, it must be because he is favored by the Prime Minister. The fact is that everybody gets a chance, and if he is good enough, he will succeed. But the feeling of people at that time when I was Prime Minister was that anybody who succeeds must be because he's a crony of the Prime Minister. So what I had to do, if I don't want to be accused of cronyism, is to ensure that nobody succeeds in Malaysia. When nobody succeeds, then they will say, I had no cronies. But then, of course, they will also comment about the country not being developed. But in order to develop, you have to depend upon people, actually the private sector, because they are the ones who create wealth in the country. So during my time, when I was Prime Minister, it's not because I was a dictator. It was because of the need to develop the country, to enrich the country. And governments are not good at enriching the country. Governments are good at collecting taxes. But if the people are poor, who are they going to tax? So we must enrich the people first and make them make their businesses profitable. Then they would have to pay corporate tax and income tax. That is where the government gets the money. So when the government works with the private sector, it doesn't mean that it is a form of cronyism. It is a way in order a way to enrich people, to help create wealth for the government to tax. The government is doing the best business possible. They don't have to invest even a single cent. The private sector will invest millions and billions, When the private sector makes money, 24% of that money belongs to the government. That is, I think, good business. You don't have to invest even a single cent, and yet you can make more money than the private sector. That is how I see government in Malaysia. We work very well with the private sector under a concept called Malaysia Incorporated, and because of that, Malaysia has prospered to the point of being called an Asian tiger. I think it was a small tiger, not very big tiger, but we became well off because of the so-called cronyism practiced by the Prime Minister. So I would like to rest there.
Thank you for that speech, Prime Minister. Now, I wanted to start by asking, you spoke about the importance of democracy and your role in that. Why, as you were entering into your 90s, did you feel a sense of duty to return into mainstream Malaysian politics, and why do you think it had to be you that stood to take on the role of the Prime Minister?
Well, it was not my wish to come back as Prime Minister. 1 week after I stepped down, the whole system changed. All the projects that were agreed between us were dropped. And in its place, we find the Prime Minister had his children, and his children were involved in making use of the Prime Minister's authority to enrich himself. At that stage, people came to see me. Very early on, they came to see me in groups and asked me, please do something. They didn't specify what I need to do. They said, please do something. So I tried to advise the Prime Minister. It didn't work. Finally, I had to resign from the party because of the first Prime Minister. And unfortunately, he resigned after the elections in 2008 and was replaced by another person. But again, the people came to ask me, please do something, because of what the Prime Minister was doing. And in the end, I had to leave the party, join the opposition, and help the opposition overthrow the government. That's the story.
Did you feel as though it had to be you to take on that mantle specifically?
No question of my belief. It's a question of those people's belief that I can do something.
Now, as you know, the union, the Oxford Union, was founded on the principles of free speech, honest and honest debate. In that vein, I wanted to ask you about the Internal Security Act. Upon re-entering the role of Prime Minister, did you feel the need to defend your record on civil liberties, having used the ISA, as some have argued, as a tool for suppressing free speech and honest debate?
I don't have to explain about my past, although I was accused of many things. I think the most important thing is to work together with the opposition parties, form a new government, and then correct whatever mistakes was done by the previous government.
I suppose the question is, do you feel the need to address the perhaps mistakes or the accusations and the criticisms that were made about your use of the ISA?
What I feel is not important. What the people feel is very important. They feel that I should go back, otherwise they wouldn't have given such support to me and the opposition group. Every time we have a rally, 20,000 people would attend. But the government party cannot draw that number of people. So it's the people who wanted, at least, well, I assume, that they wanted me to come back. But the opposition party also proposed that I should be the leader of the opposition.
Then, following on from that, and you spoke about it in your speech as well, you promised after re-election to focus on the restoration of the rule of law. But then my question is, I suppose with the establishment of the investigation into the One Malaysian Development Bahas scandal, how can you reassure both Malaysians and the international community that this isn't another tool to facilitate an opposition crackdown similar to what happened with the ISA?
Well, we decided that the Prime Minister should not have too much power. So we've shifted the power to the Parliament in the case of choosing senior officials, etc. It is no longer the Prime Minister who will name the person concerned. It will be the Parliament. Parliament will have a select committee to choose the persons to hold whatever job that may be. So I have actually agreed to reducing the power of the Prime Minister, because that power can be abused. During my time, people did not demonstrate against me. So that's because I didn't abuse, at least in the eyes of the people concerned, I did not abuse the authority conferred on me. But the last Prime Minister openly showed that he was corrupt, that he had taken government money, etc., because he feels that he is very powerful and cannot be defeated.
I suppose my question was, with both examples, and you used the example of protest, both of these policies have been used to clamp down on opposition voices within the Malaysian opposition, both when you've now switched the floor on both times. Do you feel as though you have to address that point? And is that even if people might not be protesting you, that is because, in some respects, there has been a clampdown on that using the ISA and the new establishment of the committee?
What is the question exactly?
So my question is about your clamping down of opposition voices. You say that no one had protested you before. Do you not accept that that is in part because of the use of the ISA previously?
No, the ISA was already annulled. It's no longer operating. But the previous government enacted a new law which is even more severe than the ISA. I am against that. I was also against ISA during my time, but the enforcers, the police and the others, they did not want to have the ISA removed because of certain needs of the country.
Then moving on to a more international sphere, when addressing the United General Assembly in September last year, you said that the international community rewards Israel for breaking international law. And my question is, even if that were the case, do you not think that that statement might be slightly hypocritical in light of your record with the ISA and the history of that respecting human rights and international law?
I didn't get your point. Is it about Israel, you said?
So my point is that you've said that the international community rewards Israel when it breaks international law and it doesn't respect human rights. And my question is, do you not think that might be slightly hypocritical based on the use of the ISA and the ISA's role in respecting international law and human rights?
No, the ISA is meant for detaining only people who are a threat to the nation. It was enacted during the time when we were a colony. Of course, after independence, we still need the law, because the country would be totally unstable if you find that people who threaten the community are free to do what they like. So the ISA was meant for detaining those people. But I must admit that at times the government detained political opponents. That was wrong. That is why I wanted to annul the law, but the police and the other enforcers feel that the law is needed.
Now, with specific reference to the ban that you've imposed on Israeli swimmers taking part in the World's Para Swimming Championships, do you think it's legitimate to penalise individual Israeli citizens who may also be critical of the regime in this way?
Well, many countries today are seeing outsiders coming to their country and not very happy about it. They're overthrowing their governments because their government allowed immigrants to come in. So a country has a right to keep its borders closed to certain people. That's why borders are there. But in Malaysia, we have had no diplomatic relation with Israel at all. And we don't think that that they should come to our country because we have no relations with them. And we feel that they were doing a lot of wrong things, but getting away with it because nobody dares to say anything against them.
But I suppose my question was, you may think that true of the Israeli state and the government of Israel, but is it fair to penalize the individual Israeli citizens from taking part in this championship?
Well, it is not fair to call me anti-Semitic. They should call other people anti-Semitic. I'm not anti-Semitic. The Arabs are all Semitic people.
Well, I did want to come on to that point. You've previously called and defended yourself in calling the Jewish people hooked nose and saying that they have an instinctive sense of money. Statements like that are anti-Semitic. But my question is, why do you oppose the actions of the Israeli government, not with criticisms of those actions themselves, but with racist anti-Semitic remarks like those targeted at the Jewish people?
I can understand this. We talk about freedom of speech, and yet you cannot say anything against Israel, against the Jews. Why is that so? If we are free to say what we like, we can say that we are something that will be regarded as anti-Semitic by the Jews. That is their right to hold such opinion of me. It is my right to tell them also that they have been doing a lot of wrong things.
But that in fact wasn't the point of the question. The point of the question was, these are remarks targeted at individual Jews, not the Israeli government. So why don't you oppose the Israeli government's actions directly instead of attacking with these remarks the Jewish people themselves?
Well, it seems that most of them support the stand taken by Netanyahu against the Arabs. So when I say only the Zionists, people do not understand. What they do understand is the word Yahudi or Jews. That is what they understand. If I take action against this team, cricket team, it's not wrong. Because, for example, Europe wants to declare palm oil as poisonous. Why do you hurt the poor palm farmer in Malaysia? Because you dislike the government.
I think the essence of the question was different, and I'll return to it again. It was that you can criticise the actions of the Israeli government without criticising, in this kind of anti-Semitic way, the Jewish people themselves. And do you regret targeting the Jewish people themselves, not the Israeli government, in these cases?
Well, we can't do very much about the Israeli government. They are very powerful. So we don't say anything about the Israeli government. But we don't have to show friendship towards them. If they want to come to our country, we have borders which we guard to allow only people whom we like to come to Malaysia. But the people who have done a lot of wrong things, if we consider them as unfit to visit Malaysia, that is our right.
But then, even if what you believe you are saying to be true, why do you think these reactionary racist politics is the way to finding a road to the two-state solution that you so desire?
How's that?
So your policy is in support of the two-state solution, but why do you think these kind of remarks help achieve that goal instead of finding some kind of constructive way of building that solution?
I don't know about constructive way. This is a government that doesn't care about the opinions of others. That's why they keep on committing war crimes all the time. So what I say is what I have a right to say. But if they don't like it, they can say they don't like it. I don't care.
But it's, with all due respect, it's not about caring. It's about creating a climate of politics that isn't anti-Semitic or racist. And do you think that these kind of statements aid that process or hinder the process of achieving a solution?
Or achieving?
A solution.
A solution should be, should go down to finding out the reasons for the behavior of the Jews and of the Arabs. This did not happen 70 years ago, did not happen. Until you create the state of Israel, you took Arab land and gave to Israel, and the Arabs were expelled from Palestine. Is that right? But the people supported. I am surprised that reasonable Democrats keep on supporting the act of seizure of foreign land to create a nation for somebody.
I think on that point, it would be a good time to open up the floor to audience questions. I'll take the hand at the very far back left. Yes, you, sir. Sorry, not you, sir. Yes, yeah. To my left, yeah.
You said a few minutes earlier, unless I'm mistaken, that it was wrong to detain political opponents. Do you therefore accept that you were yourself responsible for setting back your country's political development when you subverted the judiciary and manipulated the organs of government in the late 90s to detain your deputy on charges of sodomy for something like 20 years? Do you also further accept that, far from being reluctant to democratize quickly, you've actively abused human rights using antiquated and unjust laws such as the ISA and laws concerning sodomy?
I couldn't get what you say. Are you referring to whom are you referring?
I'm referring to Mr. Ibrahim, your Deputy Prime Minister.
Huh?
Anwar Ibrahim, your Deputy Prime Minister from the 90s.
Deputy?
Anwar Ibrahim.
Oh. Even if I tell you the truth, you're not going to believe it.
What is the truth?
He was tried in a court of law 9 months before he was sentenced to jail. And my successor immediately released him. But now I'm a good friend of his. Because we consider getting rid of Najib as Prime Minister as far more important than something that happened in the past.
So do you reject the claims that you have yourself weakened your country's rule of law in the decades that you were in power?
Do you reject the claims that you yourself have subverted the rule of law in Malaysia whilst you were in power?
I followed the rule of law. That is why the thing was decided by the court, not by me. 9 months trial, and he brought in any number of witnesses. All kinds of things were shown in the court. What else you ask for? If he had appeared before me and said, I want to sack you, then you have a right to complain. But you say it about the rule of law. The rule of law says that if you commit something wrong, you will be charged and tried in a court of law, and it is the judges who will decide, not me.
Is sodomy something wrong?
Is sodomy something wrong?
In our society, it is wrong. If you want to do yourself, go ahead. But in England, but not in Malaysia.
Yeah, and we'll take the question, if you just want to pass the microphone along.
Thank you, Mr. Prime Minister. As to your point about people having to be ready and waiting for their time to be democratic, depending on where they are in a sort of scale of civilization, I just want to point out that I'm from India, the world's largest democracy, which I don't know had very much preparation before it became the world's largest multi-party democracy, despite having over 400 million illiterate people. So where does that example stand in the larger history of people becoming democratic? Thank you.
I'm sorry, must be my hearing is very bad. But if you speak a little bit more slowly, I might understand.
My question was that when you look at the example of India, the world's largest democracy, it is a country with over 400 million illiterate people, and yet I don't know that it ever waited to become democratic at the right time. And so when one sees democratic aspirations expressed in various parts of the world, why do we disregard them based on the conditions of those societies rather than the aspirations themselves? And to follow on about that point, I know that you and other Southeast Asian leaders like the late Lee Kuan Yew have cited the example of democracies in Europe and the United States. But of course, the world's largest democracy is none of those, and we get along better than most, I would say.
Well, it is fair for everybody to speak his own mind because we have free speech, but it is also my right not to listen to what people say.
I think we'll take another question on that.
And on the question of democratic aspirations among various peoples, are they legitimate or not, regardless of where these people are in a sort of scale of civilization?
Well, if you go up to somebody and curse him in his face, I think he has a right to do something to you, might slap you. But he doesn't do anything like that. He expresses his opinions in some other place where I cannot reach him. Whether I listen to him or not is a matter of choice for me, not for him.
Let's go to the hand, yeah, you sir. Not you sir, the hand.
Thank you.
If you'd like to stand up.
You said that Malaysia had to negotiate for its freedom or its independence. You have this last year intervened in a number of Chinese-led development projects, and you have also talked in Beijing about a new form of colonialism. Do you think that Malaysia now has to negotiate its independence from China?
I was in China. Somebody talks about Chinese wanting to dominate, etc. Well, they can talk about that, but it's not necessary for me to just agree. I pointed out that there are other forms of colonialism, including economic colonialism. That is my right to answer.
Just to follow on, even though that is your right, do you think it is the case?
Do you think?
Do you now think you have to stand up to China in the form of...
No, I have to express my opinion. I cannot always be saying nice things to everybody. Sometimes I say nasty things and they have a right to say nasty things to me.
We'll pass the microphone just along to the hand. Yes, sir.
It's me. Take a seat. Please. Prime Minister, welcome to Oxford. So I'm from Pakistan, and I understand that it takes a while to get to democracy. We had 60 years of dictatorship, after which we've had 10 years of democracy now. So I understand that it takes some time, but the idea of democracy is predicated on equality of opportunity. So since 1957, since you've been independent, how do you then justify practices like, what is it, Pitra Bhumi? Bhumi Putra, which is affirmative action for a specific part of the society and not the other, because that is not equality of opportunity. Eventually, democracy has been the form of government that has been running successfully for the past 200 years or even more. How do you justify your stance on that?
Well, you are talking about Bhumiputra?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. The American Bhumiputras do not want the Mexican to cross their border. Why? They have a right. They can say what they like. They want to go to your country, they should go. But they erect a wall. And now Americans are not being paid their salary. That is the kind of reaction you see from great democracies. We are not so great.
I'm not satisfied by the answer, by the way. No.
We'll go to the hand in the front row in the red jacket.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Just following up from that last question, it is my understanding that Bhumiputra isn't a policy against immigrants coming into Malaysia, but rather certain ethnic groups that have historically been in Malaysia for almost centuries. In that situation, how do you still justify the exclusion of certain people? And do you think that this creates a lack of cohesion in Malaysian society when you divide it into Indians, Chinese people, and Malay people?
Well, a country has a right to determine who should come, who should not be allowed to come into their country, especially to become citizens. But Malaysia was very generous. The Bumiputra, the indigenous people, accepted people who were brought by the British to Malaysia. And we gave them citizenship, and they, well, they are not Bumiputras, of course, but that is the right of the Bumiputras to at least secure themselves. You know, if this, well, if your country is accept too many foreigners, what would happen? Supposing there are 1.4 billion Chinese, suddenly a billion of them want to go to Pakistan, for example. Would the Pakistanis open the door and welcome them? We do. But in Malaysia, we were more generous. We allowed foreign people who were of foreign origin, who still identify themselves with their countries of origin, to be Malaysians. We are not like Myanmar, where people living in their own country are now declared as non-citizens. We are very open, more open than most countries in Europe.
And yeah, we'll take the hand on the front row. You, sir, in the red.
Yeah. Singapore and Malaysia are again embroiled in an unnecessary and potentially internecine maritime dispute. Just days after the two countries' foreign ministers met and agreed to de-escalate the issue, you have the Johor chief minister unilaterally deciding to visit a Malaysian vessel docked in the disputed waters. And he said that he got the unofficial blessing from the foreign minister. Earlier today, we hear Wisma Putra saying that there was no blessing and that they told him not to go. So if we take Wisma Putra's word at face value, I'd like to ask, what actions would you take against the Johor Menteri Besar? And would you put any measures in place to ensure that something like this would not happen again, one? And two, would you not agree, Tun Dr. Mahathir, that actions like this contribute to the perception that your government is pugnacious, that your government acts in bad faith, and that your government, in the words of Najib Razak, wants a return to the days of confrontational diplomacy and barbed rhetoric?
You're welcome to choose Najib, but unfortunately, I think you are not a Malaysian citizen, so you have no right. Are you a Malaysian?
The question wasn't choosing Najib over you. I simply quoted Najib's views on your foreign policy. The question is whether through your actions over the high-speed rail, the airspace, the maritime dispute, the crooked bridge, the water price revision, you want a return to the fraught diplomatic ties with Singapore that we saw during your initial tenure as PM, or if you want to go beyond that?
Well, I'll tell you this. Singapore buys water, raw water, from Malaysia. How much does Singapore pay? 1 cent. For 1,000 gallons, they pay 1 Singapore cent, equal to 3 Malaysian cents. Since 1926. You mean to say prices don't change? And then this, yes?
Malaysia has had the opportunity to revise the 1962 water agreement, and Singapore sells treated water back to Johor at a subsidized price, and we sell 11,000 gallons per day, more than what we are obligated to do under the agreement.
Well, do you think that buying water at 3 cents per thousand gallons and then selling it at $60 per thousand gallons of clean water, do you think that is fair to Malaysia, that we receive 3 cents?
It may not be fair, but out of goodwill, Singapore has sold more water at a subsidized price. We've sold 11,000 more per day than what we are obliged to. And Malaysia had the chance, you had the chance to revise the water agreement. You didn't take the chance.
I took the chance before, but Singapore refuses. And refuses also to go to the courts for that. But anywhere in the world, when you tell them that Singapore buys water at 3 cents per 1,000 gallons and then sells treated water at 50 cents to Malaysia, that is not a good deal. We have to get, we get only 3 cents per 1,000 gallons. In some cases in Singapore, it is $60 per 1,000 gallons of treated water. The cost of treatment is very, very little, and yet Singapore makes tons of money. I don't like to say this openly. I like to talk to the leaders. But since you asked the question, this is grossly unfair to pay 3 cents, 3 Malaysian cents, which is equivalent to one half a US cent, if the US still has cents. But when we asked to negotiate the price, because we, they can sell to us at a higher price also, but we want to negotiate the price that is much more reasonable. Paying 3 cents for 1,000 gallons is absurd. In 1926, when the figure was mentioned,
62.
It was okay at that time, but it's no, not okay now. We are different countries. We have to get back our money. For years, Singapore has benefited by buying water at 3 cents per 1,000 gallons and then selling treated water at about $60 per 1,000 gallons.
I take your point, Dr. Mahathir, but my initial question was about the maritime dispute and whether you're going to take any measures to prevent something like the Menteri Besar going into the waters unilaterally again. If you could answer that, I'd be most grateful as well. Thank you.
Well, the Menteri Besar went without our permission. He thought that it was Johor waters, that's why he went there. I mean, the reaction to his going there is quite severe, as if you're going to war. I mean, he is going to go in a ship into neutral water.
Okay, I think I'll pass on the mic to someone else, but these are not neutral waters. They are waters that even in your 1979 map that we don't recognize, you haven't actually claimed those before until you suddenly came out last year and said, oh, these are now suddenly Malaysia's territorial waters. But I'll pass it on to someone else.
It is not Singapore water either. It is international water. And the Menteri Besar can go into international water without Singapore sending warships to chase him away.
I fundamentally disagree, but I'll pass it on.
Thank you. We'll take another question. Yeah, to the hand just over there.
Thank you, Prime Minister, for coming to Oxford. It's a long way from Malaysia, I can tell. My question is about Chinese investment. Just now, there was someone raising questions about Chinese new colonialism. Recently, there's been a lot of what the Chinese government calls hysteria around the company called Huawei, the phone company that also builds communication towers. I think it was only yesterday that Oxford denied all the sponsorships and grants from Huawei for issues that they did not disclose. So on the matter of Huawei, what's your attitude on this, especially their future involvement in the 5G communication tower in Malaysia? Do you share the sort of strategic concerns that the US government does? In general, what's your view on Huawei's investment? Thank you.
What's the name of the company?
Huawei.
Huawei. Huh? Huawei.
Huawei.
Oh, the Chinese company, who one of the huh? Is one of the daughters or what? There is something between China and Canada, I mean Canada or U.S. We feel the effect of this trade war between them, but we don't have any say about whether they should stop or do anything. These are big powers. They are very, very powerful. We are small countries. We cannot tell them to do what we like them to do.
Yes, my question isn't about a trade dispute between China and the U.S. My question is about whether you have any strategic concerns about Huawei building communication towers in Malaysia. A lot of Western governments nowadays, the U.S., Germany, the U.K., even Poland, they seem to think that they can't let Huawei do this anymore. What's your view on Huawei's role in Malaysia in the future?
We have not caught them doing anything wrong in Malaysia. What Germany wants to do is for Germany to decide. What Canada wants to do also is for them to decide. But Malaysia does not just follow what other people are doing. We have to study and find out whether there is a basis for the action that they took against this company.
Thank you.
Another question. Yeah, could you get the hand just down here, please?
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister, for being here. Given the uneasy situation with Singapore, with the benefit of historical hindsight, do you believe that it was the right decision for Malaysia to expel Singapore in the first place, or would things not have turned out so well for either party?
Please repeat yourself that glaring.
With the benefit of historical hindsight, do you believe it was the right decision for Malaysia to expel Singapore from the country in the 70s?
That has happened a long time ago. We cannot do anything about it, so we don't question whether it was right or wrong. But the fact is that Singapore was a part of Malaysia before. It is our country. Normally, when a country decides to decolonize, the land goes back to the owner of that land, to the country which owns that land. That happens to Hong Kong, to Macau, and other places. But in our case, we find that Singapore, people in Singapore are not compatible with the people in Malaysia. They have a different viewpoint and different ideas about how a country should be ruled. So it is for that reason that they were asked to leave Malaysia. And I think it was a wise decision at that time.
And let's take two final questions. Yeah, one from the hand in the back. Sorry. You want to stand up, sir?
Thank you, Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. I'm from Australia, and in the history of Australia and Malaysia, there have been some good times and there have also been some not so good times. However, in recent years, there have been a number of important areas of cooperation. On the multilateral level, there's been the five-power defence arrangements, as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. On the bilateral level, there's been the Australia-Malaysia Free Trade Agreement, the Colombo Plan, and now the new Colombo Plan. So, however, a lot of those happened under Najib Razak, and before indeed. But my question is, how do you see Australia and Malaysia cooperating in the future on the bilateral and the multilateral level?
Well, we consider Australia as a friendly country. Of course, like all countries, sometimes they say things which are not palatable to us, and sometimes we say things which are not palatable to them. I mean, while you are friends, sometimes you have a need to tell a friend that you have done something wrong. If you tolerate everything that somebody does because he is a friend, then you are no friend. So we tell Australia that because they decided to to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, that will only cause a lot of people to get very angry, and some of them might become terrorists because of that. That's what I told the Prime Minister. It's up to him to do what he likes, of course. He has a right. But what I think will happen is that you are causing a lot of people to feel very angry, and they are frustrated, and when they cannot do anything, they go and blow themselves up in your country. That's what will happen.
And then we'll take one final question. Yep, can you go to the hand for the lady just in there? Yeah, if you'd like to stand up. No, to the lady, yep. No. You can both go, we'll do two more. Yeah, you, madam, and then to the hand in front, yeah. You'd like to go first, and then we'll go to the one.
So I would like to ask about biodiversity in Malaysia. You have one of the most biodiverse countries in the world, and climate change is coming, we can't deny it. I would like to know what your plans are with also developing Malaysia as a country, making it more of an Asian tiger. Are you doing anything sustainable with your development, as well as preserving the precious wildlife and ecosystems that you have?
What is it that you say?
As you develop as a country, what are you doing to preserve the biodiversity of Malaysia?
Well,
biodiversity, environmental concerns.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that we cannot create an environment that is all to our liking. We have to accept things as they are, and we are very tolerant towards certain things happening in our country. But the main thing, of course, is that if you don't break the law, you are okay. Yeah?
I don't think you quite understood my question. What I'm asking is, what are you doing in terms of your development and your political policy for preserving the environment and leaving your country as beautiful as it is? Because you have palm oil plantations which are expanding at an ever-growing rate. What are you doing anything to have sustainable growth?
What is our sustainable development policy in protecting our environment, at the same time developing our country?
Yeah. Well, we, of course, all governments, all countries want to become developed. But of course, we are aware about the environment. We have preserved our environment much more than most developed countries. Malaysia still retains 50% of the land covered by forests, but we have to have living space. So sometimes we have to clear some forests, but generally we want to preserve what is natural, naturally found in Malaysia. We are very concerned about the environment. We want to clean up. We want to ensure that animals, for example, remain, thrive in Malaysia. We have about 200 tigers left, and we are looking after the tigers. Of course, tigers sometimes eat people, but that is, well, it's the fall of the people who get eaten. But anyway, we care for the environment, and we will ensure that our development is sustainable.
And then the final question from the hand just in front.
Hi. Thank you very much, Tun Mahathir, for being here and for giving that speech. I wanted to draw your attention to what you said about Bumiputera rights and indigenous rights earlier. And recently, the federal government has decided to take on the case for the Temiar Orang Aslis in Kelantan to sue the past government on behalf of their breach of fiduciary duty to the Orang Aslis. And I was just wondering, I mean, this is a very late development, I would say, because fiduciary duties has been breached by both the federal and the state governments to Orang Aslis for the past 60 over years. And I'm wondering if yes, this case would potentially set very important precedent for the way orang asli rights are regarded in the future in Malaysia, but what guarantee can you give that this isn't just a political strategy against the past government and for the recent federal government to gain support? I'm hoping that this is a more genuine attempt to protect the orang asli rights because they have been given very different treatment compared to other Bumiputras. That's all. Thank you.
Well, I don't know about the difference that you mentioned, but I know that special attention is paid to the well-being of the orang asli. In fact, in Malaysia, the number of orang asli has increased, whereas we see in some other countries the orang asli have a diminishing number because they are not well looked after. But in Malaysia, as you can see, an orang asli can rise to the level of being assistant commissioner of police. That is a very high rank. That's how we treat the orang asli. Not wanting to keep them in the forest, eating whatever animal they could find in the forest, but we want to educate them. We want them to share in the prosperity of the country. And they are now accepted in many places, and they have become senators in our parliament. And also we have sent them abroad for studies up to university level. I don't see that happening in many other countries where there are orang aslis.
Thank you very much for answering those questions, Prime Minister. That's the end of questions. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to join me in thanking the Prime Minister for joining us today. Thank you, sir. Before I head out with you.